Fans, nice to have you back with us here as we talk some baseball with you on this evening show. And we're joined by a gentleman. He's an author. McFarland Books publishes his work. And we've had him on before, and the books are terrific. And it is Joe Niese, N-I-E-S-E. And the book we're going to talk about tonight is Burley Grimes, Baseball's Last Legal Spitballer. So folks know about Joe. He's a librarian, a member of Sabre. He lives in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. And he has a website, which is Joe Niese, N-I-E-S-E.com. Joe, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back, Marty. Appreciate it.
Oh, very good. You know, this one caught my attention, and, you know, the fans know that I like good stories of baseball. And Burley Grimes, and, you know, being a kid from Brooklyn, we called them Boily Grimes, of course, with a New York accent. Yeah. But he was baseball's last legal spitballer, but he pitched during a period of time, from about 1916 up, past about 1934 or so. And baseball changed dramatically over his career, including trying to exclude the spitball, which baseball could not do completely because he had pitched with it before they went into this ban, so he was grandfathered in. But he had an amazing baseball career. Tell us about Burley Grimes and the early years in Major League Baseball for him, because those were years in the country that were kind of we're experiencing a little bit of that right now. So go ahead.
Yeah, so he started out with the Pirates in September of 1916. And had a good call up, and they thought he was going to be this kind of the bedrock of their rotation along with Wilbur Cooper. And he ended up having this horrible 1917 season for the Pirates. It was horrible for them as well. They went through three different managers, and it came up after the 17th season. The Pirates owner Barney Dreyfus came to him and said, I'm going to start this movement to do away with trick pitches, including the spitball, and I want you to go to the minor leagues and learn a different pitch. And Grimes, ever the competitor and kind of, you know, would have standoffs with owners all the time, said, no, I'm not doing it. And so we ended up getting traded to the Brooklyn Dodgers prior to the 1918 season. And so the 17th season, go ahead, Marty.
No, please go ahead. A lot was going on in the world at that time, which sort of challenged baseball, the very existence of baseball. And that's sort of what got my attention this time through. So go ahead.
Yeah. So in 17, the U.S. was getting involved in World War One. He got exempted because he was the sole provider for his wife. And then he got traded to the Dodgers. And that spring was really when kind of what we're seeing now, the Spanish flu was going around then, and he caught it in spring training. His wife did, several of his teammates did as well, and they were laid up for much of spring training.
Yeah, and then we had the military, which was, in 1918, there was a question whether there would be a season. He had got involved. You had to enlist or you were going to get drafted. That got him as well. So that was part of his world, too.
Yes, it was. Yep, he was in the Naval Reserves. He had gotten exemption again, and they kind of said either you're going to go to a munitions factory or you need to enlist. And so he had gotten into the Naval Reserves. He never saw any action overseas.
Boy, so Burley Grimes. Okay, so now he's back, and now it's 1919, and he's a Brooklyn Dodger. His manager is very interesting, a fellow by the name of Wilbert Robinson, and of course, we know a lot about the Giants and John McGraw. Robinson and McGraw were great friends, and then they had a tremendous falling out. You want to talk about their falling out? Because Robinson then manages the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Yeah, so Robinson, as you said, Robinson and McGraw were very good friends from their playing days with the Baltimore Orioles. And McGraw was having some problems with pitchers, and he recruited Robinson to become his pitching coach. And Robinson really, players took off under him, particularly Rube Marquard. But there started to be some problems between the two, and that really, in the 1913 World Series, I think it was, where he and McGraw, they kind of came to a head with something, and they got into a fight. You know, the Giants lost the World Series. McGraw blamed Robinson for some actions, and they had a falling out. And Ebbitt saw that opportunity and nabbed Robinson to be his manager.
Old Stubblebeard, that's what they called Burley Grimes. Now, he's a spitballer. He's danced around, and, you know, through the military, he got past that. He got past the influenza epidemic that was going on there. But they called him Old Stubblebeard, and he was this last legal spitballer. What was he? Why did they call him Old Stubblebeard?
So he always, the day before he pitched, he didn't shave, and so he had this 5 o'clock shadow whenever he pitched. And, you know, in an era of when men were mostly clean shaven, it was kind of, people thought it was for the intimidation factor. It was because of, you know, he didn't chew tobacco. He chewed the bark of a slippery elm tree for the lubricant for the spitball. Okay. And so that really irritated his skin when he pitched, as well as the rosin that was on towels in the dugout. So he kind of had this barrier between his skin and that to soften the blow a little bit.
All right, that was Burley Grimes, baseball's last legal spitballer. Well, now we get to 1920, and it becomes interesting because now we have the live ball era. He pitched in the dead ball era. Now we've got the ball flying all over the place. And in 1920, the Brooklyn Dodgers win the National League pennant, and they end up in a World Series against the Cleveland Indians. Now, this is a best-of-nine World Series, and he was their best pitcher, arguably, at that time for the Brooklyn Dodgers, but he doesn't get to start the World Series. What happened?
Yeah, so it was kind of, Robinson had, as I mentioned, Rube Marquardt was one of his favorite pitchers, and he had a real affinity to him. He ended up starting Marquardt in the first game of the 1916 World Series as well, over Jeff Pfeffer, who was the better pitcher on the team. And then in the 1920 World Series, he ends up starting Marquardt again in game one. And I think it was that kind of his affinity for Marquardt. They're actually playing in Cleveland, where Marquardt, or playing against Cleveland, where Marquardt was from Cleveland. So kind of all things pointed to Robinson wanting to give Marquardt the nod over Grimes, who you said was the best pitcher on the, I think the best pitcher on the team that year.
Well, Marquardt, a former Giant, had the long winning streak. I know we've done a show on him as well. All right, so it's 1920, and it's a World Series, and it's a very special time in baseball. The golden era is starting to happen. Babe Ruth and the home runs are starting to happen. And this turns out to be a very monumental World Series for noteworthy events. And Burley Grimes is right in the middle of a few of them. So I know a few things happened in that World Series that he may not want to take credit for, but he was there.
Yeah, he gave up first Grand Slam the World Series. He gave up a home run to a pitcher as well. And so, I mean, he was on the wrong end of a couple different things in the World Series that year.
Well, he goes to Game 7, which is a Game 7, of course, but it's a nine-game series. But Game 7 to try to keep the Dodgers into it, and he throws a spitball. But apparently one of his teammates was giving away the sign when he was going to go to the spitball, which you detail in the book, which I really thought was quite interesting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so they thought it was actually Otto Miller, the catcher, that was doing it. They thought that every time he would throw some dirt down, but it was actually Kilduff, the second baseman, and that was in the batter's line of sight, that he would do that same thing, that he would pick up some dirt. If it was a fastball, he would throw it down. If it was a spitball, he would keep it in his hand in case that ball came to him. It was slick. He had a little grit in his hands to field it.
Well, it didn't work out that way because Cleveland knocked Grimes around and they ended up winning the World Series. But then he went on to have success, as I say, during a tough decade for pitchers during the 20s. We had the great hitters who could hit the ball all over the park and then the hitters who could hit it out of the park as well. So he goes from Brooklyn. He ends up with the New York Giants, the hated Giants. How did that happen?
So he had kind of peaked in the early 20s with Brooklyn, and by 25 and 26, he had losing records, was having these yearly contract squabbles with management of Brooklyn. They kind of had enough, and they ended up trading him to the Giants. And he had one of his better years that year. I think he won, was it 16 games in a row that year with them? Said if he had pitched under McGraw, his entire career would have won well over 300 games. He won 270 for his career. But he kind of wore out his welcome again in New York as well.
Joe Neese is with us. The book is Burleigh Grimes, B-U-R-L-E-I-G-H, Grimes, G-R-I-M-E-S. You get it from McFarland Publishing. And we'll talk to Joe a little bit about other areas where you can get the book. It's a very good baseball story of a very sort of romantic time of baseball as baseball is changing. He then became a star for the Cardinals in the World Series of 1930 and 31, and eventually was the big pitcher in 1931 when the Cardinals beat the very good Philadelphia Athletics team. He became a Hall of Famer in 1964 and a long career in the game after he was done pitching. So what when you talk about Burleigh Grimes and you talk to people who, you know, obviously are a lot younger than you and didn't know about that era of baseball, what do you like to tell them about Burleigh Grimes?
I think it's the competitor in him. I say that he fought everyone, teammates, umpires, opponents, managers. Wore out his welcome a lot of places he went. He played for seven different teams, but it's kind of a testament to the player that he was that they were willing to take a chance on him and see if he had more in his tank.
And he became a Hall of Famer, but he was one of those guys who, like a Sal Magley, one of those guys on the mound that you didn't want to look him in the eye because he would throw one right under your chin.
Yep, that's exactly it. Yep, didn't back down from anyone.
Well, you had a lot of fun with the book, and there's a lot of good stories in the book, as I say, and it relates to things of today with the flu epidemic back when he pitched, and, of course, with the military being involved, seasons being shortened. The 1919 season was only 140 games. The 1918 season ended around Labor Day. Those are concessions that were made to the times, which we're going through now, and that sort of attracted me to it as well. Joe, I know the book, you wrote it a while ago. Is it still available for people who want to get a copy of it?
It is, yeah. You can, as you said, McFarland has it available. You can purchase it through my website as well that you had mentioned. I'll send the autographed copy. It's on Amazon, although they're backing off of books right now as they kind of put front and center more important things at this time. But, yeah, still available out there, that's for sure.
All right. It's a good story, and I know he's a Wisconsin man just like you, and that attracted you to him as well. But when you look at the history of baseball and the years he pitched and all the success he had, does he get forgotten just a little bit? Is he under the radar just a little bit?
I think he is. And, you know, some people attribute his Hall of Fame credentials because of longevity or, you know, Ty Cobb took a real interest to him towards the end of his life. He saw Grimes was one of his favorite players, and he kind of, you know, made it his mission to get people into the Hall of Fame that he thought should be in there. And he was voted in by the Veterans Committee, who at the time, you know, people thought that they were just kind of voting in their buddies and stuff like that. So he definitely gets lost in the mix. But as you said, he was the winningest pitcher of the first decade of the live ball era. So you can't really, you can't take anything away from that.
No, good credential. And I remember the late Bill King when he was broadcasting the A's games, and I had Bill on many, many times on my show. And one of his favorite stories was getting up in the morning. Bill was broadcasting for one of the affiliates. I think it was Joplin, Missouri. And it was spring training, and Burleigh Grimes was a scout for the Yankees. And, of course, Joplin, eventually Mickey Mantle was there. And Bill told me every morning he would go and sit down with Burleigh Grimes and talk baseball, and it was one of Bill's fondest memories. So Burleigh Grimes was a real character, and we'll end with this one. He could tell a story, I believe, about baseball.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, that's an understatement, I think. Yeah,
he could. All right. Well, glad to have you on, Joe. And I know your next book is coming out on Zach Wheat, who was one of the stars of the Brooklyn Dodgers in the first, the second decade of the 20th century. So I'm looking forward to seeing that as well. And I appreciate you being on, and good luck to you. Stay healthy. And we'll look for the book Burleigh Grimes, fans. It's one worth reading while we're trying to get our baseball mojo back again. This is a good baseball story. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Marty. Appreciate it.
All right, that's Joe Neese. McFarland Publishing has always come up with very, very good baseball stories. All right, more coming up. This is 104.5 and KMBR 680, the sports leader.